jaw began to quiver. His eyes filled with tears, and he was crying. He started toward Yosarian on tiptoe to mourn beside him and share his wordless grief. At that moment, a hand grabbed him roughly around the arm, and a brusque voice demanded,
"Chaplain Tapman?"
He turned with surprise to face a stout, pugnacious colonel with a large head and mustache and a smooth, florid skin. He had never seen the man before.
"Yes? What is it?"
The fingers grasping the chaplain's arms were hurting him, and he tried in vain to squirm loose.
"Come along."
The chaplain pulled back in frightened confusion.
"Where? Why? Who are you, anyway?"
"You'd better come along with us, father,"
a lean, hawk-faced major on the chaplain's other side intoned with reverential sorrow.
"We're from the government. We want to ask you some questions."
"What kind of questions? What's the matter?"
"Aren't you Chaplain Tapman?"
demanded the obese colonel.
"He's the one,"
Sergeant Whitcomb answered.
"Go on along with him,"
Captain Black called out to the chaplain with a hostile and contemptuous sneer.
"Go on into the car if you know what's good for you."
Hands were drawing the chaplain away irresistibly. He wanted to shout for help to Yosarian, who seemed too far away to hear. Some of the men nearby were beginning to look at him with awakening curiosity. The chaplain bent his face away with burning shame and allowed himself to be led into the rear of a staff car and seated between the fat colonel with the large pink face and the skinny, unctuous, despondent major. He automatically held a wrist out to each, wondering for a moment if they wanted to handcuff him. Another officer was already in the front seat. A tall MP with a whistle and a white helmet got in behind the wheel. The chaplain did not dare raise his eyes until the closed car had lurched from the area and the speeding wheels were whining on the bumpy blacktop road.
"Where are you taking me?"
he asked in a soft voice with timidity and guilt, his gaze still averted. The notion came to him that they were holding him to blame for the mid-air crash and the death of Nately.
"What have I done?"
"Why don't you keep your trap shut and let us ask the questions?"
said the colonel.
"Don't talk to him that way," said the major. "It isn't necessary to be so disrespectful."
"Then tell him to keep his trap shut and let us ask the questions."
"Father, please keep your trap shut and let us ask the questions,"
urged the major sympathetically.
"It'll be better for you."
"It isn't necessary to call me father," said the chaplain. "I'm not a Catholic."
"Neither am I, father," said the major. "It's just that I'm a very devout person, and I like to call all men of God father."
"He doesn't even believe that there are atheists in foxholes,"
the colonel mocked and nudged the chaplain in the ribs familiarly.
"Go on, chaplain, tell him. Are there atheists in foxholes?"
"I don't know, sir," the chaplain replied. "I've never been in a foxhole."
The officer in front swung his head around swiftly with a quarrelsome expression.
"You've never been in heaven either, have you? But you know there's a heaven, don't you?"
"Or do you?"
said the colonel.
"That's a very serious crime you've committed, father," said the major.
"What crime?"
"We don't know yet," said the colonel, "but we're going to find out. And we sure know it's very serious."
The car swung off the road at group headquarters with a squeal of tires, slackening speed only slightly, and continued around past the parking lot to the back of the building. The three officers and the chaplain got out. In single file, they ushered him down a wobbly flight of wooden stairs leading to the basement and led him into a damp, gloomy room with a low cement ceiling and unfinished stone walls. There were cobwebs in all the corners. A huge centipede blew across the floor to the shelter of a water pipe. They sat the chaplain in a hard, straight-backed chair that stood behind a small, bare table.
"Please, make yourself comfortable, chaplain,"
invited the colonel cordially, switching on a blinding spotlight and shooting it squarely into the chaplain's face. He placed a set of brass knuckles and a box of wooden matches on the table.
"We want you to relax."
The chaplain's eyes bugged out incredulously. His teeth chattered, and his limbs felt utterly without strength. He was powerless. They might do whatever they wished to him, he realized. These brutal men might beat him to death right there in the basement, and no one would intervene to save him. No one, perhaps, but the devout and sympathetic major with the sharp face, who set a water tap dripping loudly into a sink, and returned to the table to lay a length of heavy rubber hose down beside the brass knuckles.
"Everything's gonna be all right, Chaplain," the major said encouragingly. "You got nothing to be afraid of if you're not guilty." "What are you so afraid of? You're not guilty, are you?"
"Sure he's guilty," said the colonel. "Guilty as hell."
Guilty of what?" implored the chaplain, feeling more and more bewildered and not knowing which of the men to appeal to for mercy. The third officer wore no insignia and lurked in silence off to the side.
What did I do?"
"That's just what we're going to find out," answered the colonel, and he shoved a pad and pencil across the table to the chaplain. "Write your name for us, will you? In your own handwriting."
"My own handwriting?"
"That's right. Anywhere on the page."
When the chaplain had finished, the colonel took the pad back and held it up alongside a sheet of paper he removed from a folder.
"See?"
he said to the major, who had come to his side and was peering solemnly over his shoulder.
"They're not the same, are they?" the major admitted.
"I told you he did it!"
"Did what?" asked the chaplain.
"Chaplain, this comes as a great shock to me," the major accused in a tone of heavy lamentation.
"What does?"
"I can't tell you how disappointed I am in you."
"For what?"
persisted the chaplain more frantically.
"What have I done?"
"For this," replied the major,
and with an air of disillusioned disgust, tossed down on the table the pad on which the chaplain had signed his name.
"This isn't your handwriting."
The chaplain blinked rapidly with amazement.
"But, of course it's my handwriting."
"No, it isn't, Chaplain. You're lying again."
"But I just wrote it,"
the chaplain cried in exasperation.
"You saw me write it."
"That's just it," the major answered bitterly. "I saw you write it. You can't deny that you did write it. A person who will lie about his own handwriting will lie about anything."
"But who lied about my own handwriting?"
demanded the chaplain, forgetting his fear in the wave of anger and indignation that welled up inside him suddenly.
"Are you crazy or something? What are you both talking about?"
"We asked you to write your name in your own handwriting, and you didn't do it."
"But of course I did! In whose handwriting did I write it, if not my own?"
"In somebody else's?"
"Whose?"
"That's just what we're going to find out," threatened the colonel.
"Talk, Chaplain."
The chaplain looked from one to the other of the two men with rising doubt and hysteria.
"That handwriting is mine," he maintained passionately. "Where else is my handwriting if that isn't it?"
"Right here," answered the colonel.
And looking very superior, he tossed down on the table a photostatic copy of a piece of V-mail in which everything but the salutation "Dear Mary" had been blocked out, and on which the censoring officer had written, "I long for you tragically, A.T. Tapman, Chaplain, U.S. Army." The colonel smiled scornfully as he watched the chaplain's face turn crimson.
"Well, Chaplain, do you know who wrote that?"
The chaplain took a long moment to reply. He had recognized Yossarian's handwriting.
"No."
"You can read, though, can't you?"
the colonel persevered sarcastically.
"The author signed his name."
"That's my name there."
"Then you wrote it, Q.E.D.
"But I didn't write it. That isn't my handwriting either."
"Then you signed your name in somebody else's handwriting again,"
the colonel retorted with a shrug.
"That's all that means."
"Oh, this is ridiculous,"
the chaplain shouted, suddenly losing all patience. He jumped to his feet in a blazing fury, both fists clenched.
"I'm not going to stand for this any longer. Do you hear? 12 men were just killed, and I have no time for these silly questions. You've no right to keep me here, and I'm just not going to stand for it."
Without saying a word, the colonel pushed the chaplain's chest hard and knocked him back down into the chair, and the chaplain was suddenly weak and very much afraid again. The major picked up the length of rubber hose and began tapping it menacingly against his open palm. The colonel lifted the box of matches, took one out, and held it, poised against the striking surface, watching with glowering eyes for the chaplain's next sign of defiance. The chaplain was pale and almost too petrified to move. The bright glare of the spotlight made him turn away finally. The dripping water tap was louder and almost unbearably irritating. He wished they would tell him what they wanted, so he would know what to confess. He waited tensely as the third officer, at a signal from the colonel, ambled over from the wall and seated himself on the table just a few inches away from the chaplain. His face was expressionless, his eyes penetrating and cold.
"Turn off the light," he said over his shoulder in a low, calm voice. "It's very annoying."
The chaplain gave him a small smile of gratitude.
"Thank you, sir. And the drip, too, please."
"Leave the drip," said the officer. "That doesn't bother me."
He tugged up the legs of his trousers a bit as though to preserve their natty crease.
"Chaplain," he asked casually, "of what religious persuasion are you?"
"I'm an Anabaptist, sir."
"That's a pretty suspicious religion, isn't it?"
"Suspicious?"
inquired the chaplain in a kind of innocent daze.
"Why, sir?"
"Well, I don't know a thing about it. You have to admit that, won't you? Doesn't that make it pretty suspicious?"
I don't know, sir,"
the chaplain answered diplomatically with an uneasy stammer. He found the man's lack of insignia disconcerting, and was not even sure he had to say sir. Who was he, and what authority had he to interrogate him?
"Chaplain, I once studied Latin. I think it's only fair to warn you of that before I ask my next question. Doesn't the word Anabaptist simply mean that you're not a Baptist?"
Oh, no, sir. There's much more."
"Are you a Baptist?"
"No, sir."
"Then you are not a Baptist, aren't you?"
"Sir?"
"I don't see why you're bickering with me on that point. You've already admitted it. Now, Chaplain, to say you're not a Baptist doesn't really tell us anything about what you are, does it? You could be anything or anyone."
He leaned forward slightly, and his manner took on a shrewd and significant air.
"You could even be," he added, "Washington Irving, couldn't you?"
"Washington Irving?"
the chaplain repeated with surprise.
"Come on, Washington," the corpulent colonel broke in irascibly. "Why don't you make a clean breast of it? We know you stole that plum tomato."
After a moment's shock, the chaplain giggled with nervous relief.
"Oh, is that it?" he exclaimed. "Now I'm beginning to understand. I didn't steal that plum tomato, sir. Colonel Cathcart gave it to me. You can even ask him if you don't believe me."
A door opened at the other end of the room, and Colonel Cathcart stepped into the basement as though from a closet.
"Hello, Colonel. Colonel, he claims you gave him that plum tomato. Did you?"
"Why should I give him a plum tomato?"
answered Colonel Cathcart.
"Thank you, Colonel. That will be all."
"It's a pleasure, Colonel,"
Colonel Cathcart replied, and he stepped back out of the basement, closing the door after him.
"Well, Chaplain, what have you got to say now?"
"He did give it to me,"
the chaplain hissed in a whisper that was both fierce and fearful.
"He did give it to me."
"You're not calling a superior officer a liar, are you, Chaplain?"
"Why should a superior officer give you a plum tomato, Chaplain.
Is that why you tried to give it to Sergeant Whitcomb, Chaplain? Because it was a hot tomato?
No, 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 the chaplain protested, wondering miserably why they were not able to understand. I offered it to Sergeant Whitcomb because I didn't want it.
Why'd you steal it from Colonel Cathcart if you didn't want it?
I didn't steal it from Colonel Cathcart.
And why are you so guilty if he didn't steal it?
I'm not guilty!
Then why would we be questioning you if you weren't guilty?
Oh, I don't know,
the chaplain groaned, kneading his fingers in his lap and shaking his bowed and anguished head.
I don't know.
He thinks we have time to waste, snorted the major.
Chaplain,
resumed the officer without insignia at a more leisurely pace, lifting a typewritten sheet of yellow paper from the open folder.
I have a signed statement here from Colonel Cathcart, asserting you stole that plum tomato from him.
He lay the sheet face down on one side of the folder and picked up a second page from the other side.
And here I have a notarized affidavit from Sergeant Whitcomb, in which he states that he knew the tomato was hot just from the way you tried to unload it on him.
I swear to God, I didn't steal it, sir!
The chaplain pleaded with distress, almost in tears.
I give you my sacred word, it was not a hot tomato.
Chaplain, do you believe in God?
Yes, sir, of course I do.
That's odd, chaplain,
said the officer, taking from the folder another typewritten yellow page.
Because I have here in my hands now another statement from Colonel Cathcart, in which he swears that you refused to cooperate with him in conducting prayer meetings in the briefing room before each mission.
After looking blank a moment, the chaplain nodded quickly with recollection.
Oh, that's not quite true, sir,
he explained eagerly.
Colonel Cathcart gave up the idea himself once he realized enlisted men pray to the same God as officers.
He did what?
Exclaimed the officer in disbelief.
What nonsense!
Declared the red-faced colonel and swung away from the chaplain with dignity and annoyance.
Does he expect us to believe that?
Cried the major incredulously. The officer without insignia chuckled acidly.
Chaplain, aren't you stretching things a bit far now?
He inquired with a smile that was indulgent and unfriendly.
But sir, it's the truth! I swear it's the truth!
I don't see how that matters one way or the other,
the officer answered nonchalantly, and reached sideways again toward the open folder filled with papers.
Chaplain, did you say you did believe in God in answer to my question? I don't remember.
Yes, sir, I did say so, sir. I do believe in God.
Then that really is very odd, Chaplain, because I have here another affidavit from Colonel Cathcart that states you once told him atheism was not against the law. Do you recall ever making a statement like that to anyone?
The chaplain nodded without any hesitation, feeling himself on very solid ground now.
Yes, I did make a statement like that. I made it because it's true. Atheism... it is not against the law.
But that's still no reason to say so, Chaplain, is it?
The officer chided tartly, frowning, and picked up still one more typewritten notarized page from the folder.
And here I have another sworn statement from Sergeant Whitcomb that says you opposed his plan of sending letters of condolence over Colonel Cathcart's signature to the next of kin of men killed or wounded in combat. Is that true?
Yes, sir. I did oppose it, answered the chaplain. And I'm proud that I did. Those letters are insincere and dishonest. Their only purpose is to bring glory to Colonel Cathcart.
But... What difference does that make?
Replied the officer.
they still bring solace and comfort to the families that receive them, don't they? Chaplain, I simply can't understand your thinking process.
The chaplain was stumped and at a complete loss for a reply. He hung his head, feeling tongue-tied and naive. The ruddy, stout colonel stepped forward vigorously with a sudden idea.
"Why don't we knock his goddamn brains out?"
he suggested with robust enthusiasm to the others.
"Yes, we could knock his goddamn brains out, couldn't we?"
the hawk-faced major agreed.
"He's only an Anabaptist."
"No, we've got to find him guilty first,"
the officer without insignia cautioned with a languid, restraining wave. He slid lightly to the floor and moved around to the other side of the table, facing the chaplain with both hands pressed flat on the surface. His expression was dark and very stern, square, and forbidding.
"Chaplain," he announced with magisterial rigidity, "we charge you formally with being Washington Irving and taking capricious and unlicensed liberties in censoring the letters of officers and enlisted men. Are you guilty or innocent?"
"Innocent, sir."
The chaplain licked dry lips with a dry tongue and leaned forward in suspense on the edge of his chair.
"Guilty,"
said the colonel.
"Guilty," said the major.
"Guilty it is, then,"
remarked the officer without insignia, and wrote a word on a page in the folder.
"Chaplain," he continued, looking up, "we accuse you also of commission of crimes and infractions we don't even know about yet. Guilty or innocent?"
"I don't know, sir. How can I say if you don't tell me what they are?"
"How can we tell you if we don't know?"
"Guilty,"
decided the colonel.
"Sure he's guilty," agreed the major. "If they're his crimes and infractions, he must have committed them."
"Guilty it is, then,"
chanted the officer without insignia, and moved off to the side of the room.
"He's all yours, colonel."
"Thank you,"
commended the colonel.
"You did a very good job."
He turned to the chaplain.
"Okay, chaplain, the jig's up. Take a walk."
The chaplain did not understand.
What do you wish me to do?"
"Go on, beat it, I told you,"
the colonel roared, jerking a thumb over his shoulder angrily.
"Get the hell out of here!"
The chaplain was shocked by his bellicose words and tone, and to his own amazement and mystification, deeply chagrined that they were turning him loose.
"Aren't you even going to punish me?"
he inquired with querulous surprise.
"You're damned right we're going to punish you, but we're certainly not going to let you hang around while we decide how and when to do it. So get going! Hit the road!"
The chaplain rose tentatively and took a few steps away.
"I'm free to go?"
"For the time being. But don't try to leave the island. We've got your number, chaplain. Just remember that we've got you under surveillance 24 hours a day."
It was not conceivable that they would allow him to leave. The chaplain walked toward the exit gingerly, expecting at any instant to be ordered back by a peremptory voice, or halted in his tracks by a heavy blow on the shoulder or the head. They did nothing to stop him. He found his way through the stale, dark, dank corridors to the flight of stairs. He was staggering and panting when he climbed out into the fresh air. As soon as he had escaped, a feeling of overwhelming moral outrage filled him. He was furious, more furious at the atrocities of the day than he had ever felt before in his whole life. He swept through the spacious, echoing lobby of the building in a temper of scalding and vindictive resentment. He was not going to stand for it anymore, he told himself. He was simply not going to stand for it. When he reached the entrance, he spied with a feeling of good fortune Colonel Korn trotting up the wide steps alone. Bracing himself with a deep breath, the chaplain moved courageously forward to intercept him.
"Colonel, I'm not going to stand for it anymore,"
he declared with vehement determination, and watched in dismay as Colonel Korn went trotting by up the steps without even noticing him.
"Colonel Korn!"
The tubby, loose figure of his superior officer stopped, turned, and came trotting back down slowly.
"What is it, Chaplain?"
"Colonel Korn, I want to talk to you about the crash this morning. It was a terrible thing to happen. Terrible!"
Colonel Korn was silent a moment, regarding the chaplain with a glint of cynical amusement.
"Yes, Chaplain, it certainly was terrible," he said finally. "I don't know how we're going to write this one up without making ourselves look bad."
"That isn't what I meant,"
the chaplain scolded firmly without any fear at all.
"Some of those 12 men had already finished their 70 missions."
Colonel Korn laughed.
"Would it be any less terrible if they had all been new men?"
he inquired caustically. Once again, the chaplain was stumped. Immoral logic seemed to be confounding him at every turn. He was less sure of himself than before when he continued, and his voice wavered.
"Sir, it just isn't right to make the men in this group fly 80 missions when the men in other groups are being sent home with 50 and 55.
"We'll take the matter under consideration,"
Colonel Korn said with bored disinterest, and started away.
"Adios, Padre."
"What does that mean, sir?"
the chaplain persisted in a voice turning shrill. Colonel Korn stopped with an unpleasant expression and took a step back down.
"It means we'll think about it, Padre,"
he answered with sarcasm and contempt.
"You wouldn't want us to do anything without thinking about it, would you?"
"No, sir, I suppose not, but you have been thinking about it, haven't you?"
"Yes, Padre, we have been thinking about it. To make you happy, we'll think about it some more. And you'll be the first person we'll tell if we reach a new decision. And now, adios."
Colonel Korn whirled away again and hurried up the stairs.
"Colonel Korn!"
The chaplain's cry made Colonel Korn stop once more. His head swung slowly around toward the chaplain with a look of morose impatience. Words gushed from the chaplain in a nervous torrent.
"Sir, I would like your permission to take the matter to General Dreidel. I want to bring my protest to wing headquarters."
Colonel Korn's thick, dark jowls inflated unexpectedly with a suppressed guffaw, and it took him a moment to reply.
"That's all right, Padre,"
he answered with mischievous merriment, trying hard to keep a straight face.
"You have my permission to speak to General Dreidel."
"Thank you, sir. I believe it only fair to warn you that I think I have some influence with General Dreidel."
"It's good of you to warn me, Padre, and I believe it only fair to warn you that you won't find General Dreidel at Wing."
Colonel Korn grinned wickedly and then broke into triumphant laughter.
"General Dreidel is out, Padre. And General Peckham is in. We have a new wing commander."
The chaplain was stunned.
"General Peckham?"
"That's right, Chaplain. Have you got any influence with him?"
Why, I don't even know General Peckham,"
the chaplain protested wretchedly. Colonel Korn laughed again.
"That's too bad, Chaplain, because Colonel Cathcart knows him very well."
Colonel Korn chuckled steadily with gloating relish for another second or two, and then stopped abruptly.
"And by the way, Padre,"
he warned coldly, poking his finger once into the chaplain's chest,
"the jig is up between you and Dr. Stubbs. We know very well he sent you up here to complain today."
"Dr. Stubbs?"
The chaplain shook his head in baffled protest.
"I haven't seen Dr. Stubbs, Colonel. I was brought here by 3 strange officers who took me down into the cellar without authority and questioned and insulted me."
Colonel Korn poked the chaplain in the chest once more.
"You know damned well Dr. Stubbs has been telling the men in his squadron they didn't have to fly more than 70 missions.
He laughed harshly.
"Well, Padre, they do have to fly more than 70 missions, because we're transferring Dr. Stubbs
to the Pacific. So adios, Padre. Adios.
37. General Shishkov. Dreidel was out, and General Peckham was in. And General Peckham had hardly moved inside General Dreidel's office to replace him when his splendid military victory began falling to pieces around him.
"General Shishkov,"
he inquired unsuspectingly of the sergeant in his new office who brought him word of the order that had come in that morning.
"You mean Colonel Shishkov, don't you?" "No, sir, General Shishkov. He was promoted to general this morning, sir." "Well, that's certainly curious. Shishkov? A general? What grade?" "Lieutenant General, sir, and..."
"Lieutenant General?"
"Yes, sir, and he wants you to issue no orders to anyone in your command without first clearing them through him."
"Well, I be damned,"
mused General Peckham with astonishment, swearing aloud for perhaps the first time in his life.
"Cargill, did you hear that? Shishkov was promoted way up to lieutenant general. I bet that promotion was intended for me, and they gave it to him by mistake."
Colonel Cargill had been rubbing his sturdy chin reflectively.
"Why is he giving orders to us?"
General Peckham's sleek, scrubbed, distinguished face tightened.
"Yes, Sergeant,"
he said slowly with an uncomprehending frown.
"Why is he issuing orders to us if he's still in special services and we're in combat operations?"
"That's another change that was made this morning, sir. All combat operations are now under the jurisdiction of special services. General Shishkov is our new commanding officer."
General Peckham let out a sharp cry.
"Oh, my God!"
he wailed, and all his practiced composure went up in hysteria.
"Shishkov in charge? Shishkov?"
He pressed his fists down on his eyes with horror.
"Cargill, give me Wintergreen! Shishkov, not Shishkov!"
All phones began ringing at once. A corporal ran in and saluted.
"Sir, there's a chaplain outside to see you with news of an injustice in Colonel Cathcart's squadron."
"Send him away! Send him away! We got enough injustices of our own! Where's Wintergreen?"
"Sir, General Shishkov is on the phone. He wants to speak to you at once."
"Tell him I haven't arrived yet." "Good Lord!"
General Peckham screamed, as though struck by the enormity of the disaster for the first time.
"Shishkov! The man's a moron! I walked all over that blockhead, and now he's my superior officer! Oh, my Lord! Cargill! Cargill, don't desert me! Where's Wintergreen?"
"Sir, I have an ex-Sergeant Wintergreen on your telephone. He's been trying to reach you all morning."
"General, I can't get Wintergreen," Colonel Cargill shouted. "His line is busy."
General Peckham was perspiring freely as he lunged for the other telephone.
"Wintergreen!"
"Peckham, you son of a bitch!"
"Wintergreen, have you heard what they've done?"
"What have you done, you stupid bastard?"
"They put Shishkov in charge of everything!"
Wintergreen was shrieking with rage and panic.
"You and your goddamn memorandums! They've gone and transferred combat operations to special services!"
"Oh, no,"
moaned General Peckham.
"Is that what did it? My memoranda? Is that what made him put Shishkov in charge? Why didn't they put me in charge?"
"Because you weren't in special services anymore. You transferred out and left him in charge. And do you know what he wants? Do you know what the bastard wants us all to do?"
"Sir, I think you'd better talk to General Shishkov," pleaded the sergeant nervously. "He insists on speaking to someone."
"Cargill, talk to Shishkov for me. I can't do it. Find out what he wants."
Colonel Cargill listened to General Shishkov for a moment and went white as a sheet.
"Oh, my God," he cried as the phone fell from his fingers. "Do you know what he wants? He wants us to march. He wants everybody to march."
38, Kid Sister. Yossarian marched backward with his gun on his hip and refused to fly any more missions. He marched backward because he was continuously spinning around as he walked to make certain no one was sneaking up on him from behind. Every sound to his rear was a warning, every person he passed a potential assassin. He kept his hand on his gun butt constantly and smiled at no one but Hungry Joe. He told Captain Pilchard and Captain Wren that he was through flying. Captain Pilchard and Captain Wren left his name off the flight schedule for the next mission and reported the matter to group headquarters. Colonel Korn laughed calmly.
"What the devil do you mean he won't fly more missions?"
he asked with a smile as Colonel Cathcart crept away into a corner to brood about the sinister import of the name Yossarian popping up to plague him once again.
"Why won't he?"
"His friend Nate Lee was killed in the crash over Spezia. Maybe that's why."
"Who does he think he is, Achilles?"
Colonel Korn was pleased with the simile and filed a mental reminder to repeat it the next time he found himself in General Peckham's presence.
"He has to fly more missions. He has no choice. Go back and tell him you'll report the matter to us if he doesn't change his mind."
"We already did tell him that, sir. It made no difference."
"What does Major Major say?"
"We never see Major Major. He seems to have disappeared."
"I wish we could disappear him,"
Colonel Cathcart blurted out from the corner peevishly,
"the way they did that fellow Dunbar."
"Oh, there are plenty of other ways we can handle this one,"
Colonel Korn assured him confidently and continued to Pilchard and Wren.
"Let's begin with the kindest. Send him to Rome for a rest for a few days. Maybe this fellow's death really did hurt him a bit."
Nately's death, in fact, almost killed Yossarian, too. For when he broke the news to Nately's whore in Rome, she uttered a piercing, heartbroken shriek and tried to stab him to death with a potato peeler.
"Brutto!"
she howled at him in hysterical fury as he bent her arm up around behind her back and twisted gradually until the potato peeler dropped from her grasp.
"Brutto! Brutto!"
She lashed at him swiftly with the long-nailed fingers of her free hand and raked open his cheek. She spat in his face viciously.
"What's the matter?"
he screamed in stinging pain and bewilderment, flinging her away from him all the way across the room to the wall.
"What do you want from me?"
She flew back at him with both fists flailing and bloodied his mouth with a solid punch before he was able to grab her wrists and hold her still. Her hair tossed wildly. Tears were streaming in single torrents from her flashing, hate-filled eyes as she struggled against him fiercely in an irrational frenzy of maddened might, snarling and cursing savagely and screaming, "Brutto! Brutto!" each time he tried to explain. Her great strength caught him off guard, and he lost his footing. She was nearly as tall as Yossarian, and for a few fantastic, terror-filled moments, he was certain she would overpower him in her crazed determination, crush him to the ground and rip him apart mercilessly limb from limb for some heinous crime he had never committed. He wanted to yell for help as they strove against each other frantically in a grunting, panting stalemate, arm against arm. At last, she weakened, and he was able to force her back and plead with her to let him talk, swearing to her that Nately's death had not been his fault. She spat in his face again, and he pushed her away hard in disgusted anger and frustration. She hurled herself down toward the potato peeler the instant he released her. He flung himself down after her, and they rolled over each other on the floor several times before he could tear the potato peeler away. She tried to trip him with her hand as he scrambled to his feet and scratched an excruciating chunk out of his ankle. He hopped across the room in pain and threw the potato peeler out the window. He heaved a huge sigh of relief once he saw he was safe.
"Now, please, let me explain something to you," he cajoled in a mature, reasoning, earnest voice.
She kicked him in the groin. Whoosh! Went the air out of him, and he sank down on his side with a shrill and ululating cry, doubled up over his knees in chaotic agony and retching for breath.
Nately's whore ran from the room. Yossarian staggered up to his feet not a moment too soon, for she came charging back in from the kitchen carrying a long bread knife. A moan of incredulous dismay wafted from his lips, as, still clutching his throbbing, tender, burning bowels in both hands, he dropped his full weight down against her shins and knocked her legs out from under her. She flipped completely over his head and landed on the floor on her elbows with a jarring thud. The knife skittered free, and he slapped it out of sight under the bed. She tried to lunge after it, and he seized her by the arm and yanked her up. She tried to kick him in the groin again, and he slung her away with a violent oath of his own. She slammed into the wall off balance and smashed a chair over into a vanity table, covered with combs, hairbrushes, and cosmetic jars that all went crashing off. A framed picture fell to the floor at the other end of the room, the glass front shattering.
"What do you want from me?"
he yelled at her in a whining and exasperated confusion.
"I didn't kill him!"
She hurled a heavy glass ashtray at his head. He made a fist and wanted to punch her in the stomach when she came charging at him again, but he was afraid he might harm her. He wanted to clip her very neatly on the point of the jaw and run from the room, but there was no clear target, and he merely skipped aside neatly at the last second and helped her along past him with a strong shove. She banged hard against the other wall. Now she was blocking the door. She threw a large vase at him. Then she came at him with a full wine bottle and struck him squarely on the temple, knocking him down half-stunned on one knee. His ears were buzzing. His whole face was numb. More than anything else, he was embarrassed. He felt awkward because she was going to murder him. He simply did not understand what was going on. He had no idea what to do. But he did know he had to save himself. And he catapulted forward off the floor when he saw her raise the wine bottle to clout him again and barreled into her midriff before she could strike him. He had momentum, and he propelled her before him backward in his driving rush until her knees buckled against the side of the bed and she fell over onto the mattress with Yossarian sprawled on top of her between her legs. She plunged her nails into the side of his neck and gouged as he worked his way up the supple, full hills and ledges of her rounded body until he covered her completely and pressed her into submission, his fingers pursuing her thrashing arm persistently until they arrived at the wine bottle finally and wrenched it free. She was still kicking and cursing and scratching ferociously. She tried to bite him cruelly, her coarse, sensual lips stretched back over her teeth like an enraged, omnivorous beast's. Now that she lay captive beneath him, he wondered how he would ever escape her without leaving himself vulnerable. He could feel the tensed straddling inside of her buffeting thighs and knees, squeezing and churning around one of his legs. He was stirred by thoughts of sex that made him ashamed. He was conscious of the voluptuous flesh of her firm young woman's body straining and beating against him like a humid, fluid, delectable, unyielding tide, her belly and warm, live, plastic breasts thrusting upward against him vigorously in sweet and menacing temptation. Her breath was scalding. All at once he realized, though the writhing turbulence beneath him had not diminished one whit, that she was no longer grappling with him, recognized with a quiver that she was not fighting him, but heaving her pelvis up against him remorselessly in a primal, powerful, rhapsodic, instinctual rhythm of erotic ardor and abandonment. He gasped in delighted surprise. Her face, as beautiful as a blooming flower to him now, was distorted with a new kind of torture, the tissues serenely swollen, her half-closed eyes misty and unseeing with the stultifying languor of desire.
"God!"
she murmured hoarsely, as though from the depths of a tranquil and luxurious trance.
"Oh, caro mio!"
He stroked her hair. She drove her mouth against his face with savage passion. He licked her neck. She wrapped her arms around him and hugged. He felt himself falling ecstatically in love with her, as she kissed him again and again with lips that were steaming and wet and soft and hard, mumbling deep sounds to him adoringly in an incoherent oblivion of rapture, one caressing hand on his back slipping deftly down inside his trouser belt, while the other groped secretly and treacherously about on the floor for the bread knife and found it. He saved himself just in time. She still wanted to kill him. He was shocked and astounded by her depraved subterfuge as he tore the knife from her grasp and hurled it away. He bounded out of bed to his feet. His face was agog with befuddlement and disillusion. He did not know whether to dart through the door to freedom or collapse on the bed to fall in love with her and place himself abjectly at her mercy again. She spared him from doing either by bursting unpredictably into tears. He was stunned again. This time she wept with no other emotion than grief, profound, debilitating, humble grief, forgetting all about him. Her desolation was pathetic as she sat with her tempestuous, proud, lovely head bowed, her shoulders sagging, her spirit melting. This time there was no mistaking her anguish. Great racking sobs choked and shook her. She was no longer aware of him, no longer cared. He could have walked from the room safely then, but he chose to remain and console and help her. "Please," he urged her inarticulately with his arm about her shoulders, recollecting with pained sadness how inarticulate and enfeebled he had felt in the plane coming back from Avignon, when Snowden kept whimpering to him that he was cold, and all Eusarion could offer him in return was, "There, there, there, there. Please," he repeated to her sympathetically, "please, please." She rested against him and cried until she seemed too weak to cry any longer, and did not look at him once until he extended his handkerchief when she had finished. She wiped her cheeks with a tiny, polite smile and gave the handkerchief back, murmuring, "Grazie, grazie," with meek, maidenly propriety, and then, without any warning whatsoever of a change in mood, clawed suddenly at his eyes with both hands. She landed with each and let out a victorious shriek.
"Ha! Assassino!"
she hooted and raced joyously across the room for the bread knife to finish him off. Half-blinded, he rose and stumbled after her. A noise behind him made him turn. His senses reeled in horror at what he saw. Nately's whore's kid sister, of all people, was coming after him with another long bread knife.
"Oh, no!"
he wailed with a shudder, and he knocked the knife out of her hand with a sharp downward blow on her wrist. He lost patience entirely with the whole grotesque and incomprehensible melee. There was no telling who might lunge at him next through the doorway with another long bread knife. And he lifted Nately's whore's kid sister off the floor, threw her at Nately's whore, and ran out of the room, out of the apartment, and down the stairs. The two girls chased out into the hall after him. He heard their footsteps lag farther and farther behind as he fled, and then cease altogether. He heard sobbing directly overhead. Glancing backward up the stairwell, he spied Nately's whore sitting in a heap on one of the steps, weeping with her face in both hands, while her pagan, irrepressible kid sister hung dangerously over the banister, shouting,
"Bruto! Bruto!"
down at him happily, and brandished her bread knife at him as though it were an exciting new toy she were eager to use. Eusarion escaped, but kept looking back over his shoulder anxiously as he retreated through the street. People stared at him strangely, making him more apprehensive. He walked in nervous haste, wondering what there was in his appearance that caught everyone's attention. When he touched his hand to a sore spot on his forehead, His fingers turned gooey with blood, and he understood. He dabbed his face and neck with a handkerchief. Wherever it pressed, he picked up new red smudges. He was bleeding everywhere. He hurried into the Red Cross building and down the two steep flights of white marble stairs to the men's washroom, where he cleansed and nursed his innumerable visible wounds with cold water and soap, and straightened his shirt collar and combed his hair. He had never seen a face so badly bruised and scratched as the one still blinking back at him in the mirror with a dazed and startled uneasiness. What on earth had she wanted from him? When he left the men's room, Nately's whore was waiting outside in ambush. She was crouched against the wall near the bottom of the staircase and came pouncing down upon him like a hawk with a glittering silver steak knife in her fist. He broke the brunt of her assault with his upraised elbow and punched her neatly on the jaw. Her eyes rolled. He caught her before she dropped and sat her down gently. Then he ran up the steps and out of the building and spent the next 3 hours hunting through the city for Hungry Joe so that he could get away from Rome before she could find him again. He did not feel really safe until the plane had taken off. When they landed in Pianosa, Nately's whore, disguised in a mechanic's green coveralls, was waiting with her steak knife exactly where the plane stopped, and all that saved him as she stabbed at his chest in her leather-soled high-heeled shoes was the gravel underfoot that made her feet roll out from under her. Yossarian, astounded, hauled her up into the plane and held her motionless on the floor in a double armlock, while Hungry Joe radioed the control tower for permission to return to Rome. At the airport in Rome, Yossarian dumped her out of the plane on the taxi strip, and Hungry Joe took right off for Pianosa again without even cutting his engines. Scarcely breathing, Yossarian scrutinized every figure warily as he and Hungry Joe walked back through the squadron toward their tents. Hungry Joe eyed him steadily with a funny expression.
"Are you sure you didn't imagine the whole thing?"
Hungry Joe inquired hesitantly after a while.
"Imagine it. You were right there with me, weren't you? You just flew her back to Rome. Maybe I imagined the whole thing, too. Why does she want to kill you for?"
"She never did like me. Maybe it's because I broke his nose, or maybe it's because I was the only one in sight she could hate when she got the news. You think she'll come back?"
Yossarian went to the officers' club that night and stayed very late. He kept a leery eye out for Nately's whore as he approached his tent. He stopped when he saw her hiding in the bushes around the side, gripping a huge carving knife and all dressed up to look like a Pianosan farmer. Yossarian tiptoed around the back noiselessly and seized her from behind.
"Caramba!"
she exclaimed in a rage and resisted like a wildcat, as he dragged her inside the tent and hurled her down on the floor.
"Hey, what's going on?" queried one of his roommates drowsily. "Hold her till I get back," Yossarian ordered, yanking him out of the bed on top of her and running out. "Hold her!"
"Let me kill him, and I'll fiki-fik you all," she offered.
The other roommates leaped out of their cots when they saw it was a girl and tried to make her fiki-fik them all first as Yossarian ran to get Hungry Joe, who was sleeping like a baby. Yossarian lifted Hoople's cat off Hungry Joe's face and shook him awake. Hungry Joe dressed rapidly. This time they flew the plane north and turned in over Italy, far behind the enemy lines. When they were over level land, they strapped a parachute on Nately's whore and shoved her out the escape hatch. Yossarian was positive that he was at last rid of her and was relieved. As he approached his tent back at Pianosa, a figure reared up in the darkness right beside the path, and he fainted. He came to, sitting on the ground, and waited for the knife to strike him, almost welcoming the mortal blow for the peace it would bring. A friendly hand helped him up instead. It belonged to a pilot in Dunbar's squadron.
"How you doing?"
asked the pilot, whispering.
"Pretty good,"
Yossarian answered.
"I saw you fall down just now. I thought maybe something happened to you."
I think I've fainted.
There's a rumor in my squadron that you told them you weren't going to fly any more combat missions.
That's the truth.
Then they came around from group and told us that the rumor wasn't true, that you were just kidding around.
Well, that was a lie.
Do you think they'll let you get away with it?
I don't know.
What will they do to you?
I don't know.
Do you think they'll court-martial you for desertion in the face of the enemy?
I don't know.
I hope you get away with it, said the pilot in Dunbar's squadron, stealing out of sight into the shadows. Let me know how you're doing.
Yossarian stared after him a few seconds and continued toward his tent.
Psst, said a voice a few paces onward. It was Appleby, hiding in back of a tree. How you doing?
Pretty good, said Yossarian.
I heard them say they were going to threaten to court-martial you for deserting in the face of the enemy, but that they wouldn't try to go through with it because they're not even sure they've got a case against you on that, and because it might make them look bad with the new commanders. Besides, you're still a pretty big hero for going around twice over the bridge at Ferrara. I guess you're just about the biggest hero we've got now in the group. I just thought you'd like to know that they'll only be bluffing.
Thanks, Appleby.
That's the only reason I started talking to you, to warn you.
I appreciate it.
Appleby scuffed the toes of his shoes into the ground sheepishly.
I'm sorry we had that fist fight in the officers' club, Yossarian.
That's all right.
But I didn't start it. I guess that was all Orr's fault for hitting me in the face with his ping-pong paddle. What did he want to do that for?
You were beating him.
Wasn't I supposed to beat him? Isn't that the point? Now that he's dead, I guess it doesn't matter anymore whether I'm a better ping-pong player or not, does it?
I guess not.
And I'm sorry about making such a fuss about those Adibran tablets on the way over. If you want to catch malaria, I guess it's your business, isn't it?
No, that's all right, Appleby.
But I was only trying to do my duty. I was obeying orders. I was always taught that I had to obey orders.
That's all right.
You know, I said to Colonel Korn and Colonel Cathcart that I didn't think they ought to make you fly any more missions if you didn't want to, and they said they were very disappointed in me.
Yossarian smiled with rueful amusement.
I'll bet they are.
Well, I don't care. Hell, you've flown 71. That ought to be enough. You think they'll let you get away with it?
No.
Say, if they do let you get away with it, they'll have to let the rest of us get away with it, won't they?
That's why they can't let me get away with it.
What do you think they'll do?
I don't know.
You think they'll try to court-martial you?
I don't know.
Are you afraid?
Yes.
Are you going to fly more missions?
No.
I hope you do get away with it, Appleby whispered with conviction. I really do.
Thanks, Appleby.
I don't feel too happy about flying so many missions either. Now that it looks as though we've got the war won, I'll let you know if I hear anything else.
Thanks, Appleby. Hey,
called a muted, peremptory voice from the leafless shrubs growing beside his tent in a waist-high clump after Appleby had gone. Havermeyer was hiding there in a squat. He was eating peanut brittle, and his pimples and large, oily pores looked like dark scales.
How are you doing?
He asked when Yossarian had walked to him.
Pretty good. Are you going to fly more missions?
No.
Suppose they try to make you?
I won't let them.
Are you yellow?
Yes.
Will they court-martial you?
They'll probably try.
What did Major Major say?
Major Major's gone.
Did they disappear him?
I don't know.
What will you do if they decide to disappear you? I'll try to stop them.
Didn't they offer you any deals or anything if you did fly? Pilchard and Wren said they'd arrange things so I'd only go on milk runs.
Havermeyer perked up.
Say, that sounds like a pretty good deal. I wouldn't mind a deal like that myself.
I bet you snapped it up.
I turned it down.
That was dumb.
Havermeyer's stolid, dull face furrowed with consternation.
Say, a deal like that wasn't so fair to the rest of us, was it? If you only flew on milk runs, then some of us would have to fly your share of the dangerous missions, wouldn't we?
That's right.
Say, I don't like that,
Havemeyer exclaimed, rising resentfully with his hands clenched on his hips.
I don't like that a bit. That's a real royal screwing they're getting ready to give me just because you're too goddamn yellow to fly on any more missions, isn't it?
Take it up with them, said Yossarian.